One case on the calendar this afternoon, an appeal from a preliminary injunction, LifeNetics versus New Psi Capital, doing business as Holiday Bright Lights, 2023-1146. Mr. Allen, please proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Vincent Allen here on behalf of LifeNetics, the appellant in the case. The appellee was a former customer of LifeNetics that decided they, or what we think, executed a failed design around attempt to get around the patents that appellee knew about. In fact, those patents were discussed in the appellee's patent that it got on its improved product.
Counsel, this is an appeal from a preliminary injunction. So you got an uphill battle. And your infringement claims are less than strong, let's say. So how do you think you can win this appeal?
Well, Jan, I think we have to look at the claim construction, first of all, under a de novo standard of review, because it's a question of law. That the Federal Circuit must decide whether the district court properly interpreted those claims, because the whole case turns on that claim construction that we think is erroneous and we think is supported by the, our position is supported by the Federal Circuit. And specifically, we think the district court committed errors of law in importing limitations from the specification into the claims, and that's a couple of different things. The first thing is the fact that it has to be a single magnet. Nowhere in the claim does it say it has to be a single magnet.
Can I ask you, counsel, do we really have to resolve that claim construction dispute, at least under the Eighth Circuit standard, at least the district courts seem to think, because we're here on state law claims, as long as your opponent, HBL, has shown a fair chance of success, that's enough. If the claim construction is disputable, isn't that enough for them to have shown a fair chance that your claims of patent infringement are objectively baseless?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. Even if the claims were disputable, it requires more than that. You know, it requires that we made the communications in bad faith. But I would say that even though the Eighth Circuit abuse of discretion applies to a preliminary injunction decision, that doesn't apply to the claim construction. And the whole basis for the court's ruling that he could avoid the privilege that was asserted is that he construed the claims in a way that he said required our case to be objectively baseless. Without that claim construction, there is no case for infringement, or I'm sorry, case for defamation.
If the district court's constructions are correct, is the district court right that your patent infringement claims are objectively baseless?
No, even if they're incorrect, there's case law that says that even if the plaintiff is incorrect in their ultimate claim construction, you still have to show that it's, you know, no reasonable litigant would have ever brought these claims. And we don't think that that is the case here. Again, I think you...
So let me just see if I understand. The preliminary injunction here is against your speaking to the public. The patent preemption rule backed by the First Amendment provides a pretty robust form of protection for a patentee speaking to the public, namely protected against state law liability unless what you say is not just wrong, but objectively baseless and, I might add, subjectively in bad faith. So all you need to do to say, I think this is your argument, to say that the preliminary injunction against speaking to the public should be set aside is to say that you had an objective basis for assertions of infringement, either literal infringement or doctrine of equivalence infringement. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. Although I'm not sure how you reach that determination without actually looking at the claim construction or the errors that the court made in deciding that claim construction. And
I thought one of your arguments is that even if you have an argument about the singular, a magnet, that by law, or at least objectively, it's reasonable to say by law means one or more magnets, and that would then get you be over the objective baselessness hurdle for the 779 patent and mm-hmm. the magnetic core. I think that's right. Is that right? The other is that even if there has to be a single magnet with at least 5 pounds of pull, cutting the magnet in half, if that's quite the, I don't know if that's quite the right way to say it, but having two half disks next to each other that together have at least 5 pounds of pull is an equivalent.
Well, it's not just an equivalent. It's the same thing. It's a literal infringement of the claim.
Right, but you make both arguments.
Right, that's
right. It's a claim construction question mm-hmm. on the literal infringement, and then even if you're wrong about the claim construction, you have a doctrine of equivalence argument.
That's correct, okay. Yes. And the court said we didn't have a doctrine of equivalence argument, again, because it used the same analysis that it did with respect to direct infringement and saying that you're barred by the specification or the statements that were made in the specification from seeking equivalence on a multi-magnet construction. However, there's nothing in the spec that talks anything about the unitary structure of the magnet, whether it has to be one piece, one piece or two pieces. There's just no discussion in the patent because it's not, that feature is not important to the overall invention.
Can you help me on how much of your case has to be objectively baseless in order for the HBL to have a claim? Let's just suppose for the sake of argument that maybe you had a reasonable basis to believe you could allege infringement against one of the products under one of the patents, but you didn't have that level of confidence in your claims with respect to the other product or the other patent. Who wins? What do we do if some of your speech is objectively baseless and some is not?
Right, I appreciate that question because the answer is we only need a non-objectively baseless claim on one product. In fact, the letter that we sent out that is being objected to by the appellee doesn't even mention what products it is that are infringing. It identifies the patent. It doesn't mention the claims. So there's no, the communication is we have patents. We're going to enforce these patents. We filed suit against the appellee. And that's it.
Well, you also call them copiers.
Well, and that's another thing. It says in the letter that we do not appreciate or something to that effect copying a patent, or we will not tolerate copying of patented products. Again, the copying goes in. It's the same thing. It's patent infringement. That's what we're alleging. And for all practical purposes, this product is a copy. The only thing they did is split it down the middle. In fact, they say in their patent that you can just split a disk magnet in two, put it together, and voila, it's non-infringing.
Well, what about the, you accuse two products, the magnetic core and the magnetic clip. What about the clip product? And I think on the clip, you just assert indirect infringement, right?
That's,
either inducement or contributory.
Yeah, that's correct.
Or both?
Yeah, we insert.
So why was that? First of all, and I, at least one of the arguments against that is or one of the reasons I think the district court rejected, is that you effectively disclaimed products that clip to the wire where the wire connects to the light bulb fixture.
Yeah, that is the argument that was made below, is that we disclaimed it because we talked about two different prior art references, Dugan and Clement, I believe are the names of them. Both of those prior art references have clips that don't clip to the base of this magnetic light or this light. It clips to the cord. So you clip it to the cord, and then you hang it on the eave of the house, or you clip it to the cord and you hang it up by the cord with a magnet. Those are the two references. These references don't talk about a magnetic clip.
In the reference, Clement, maybe, where there's a clip and a magnet, what's the arrangement?
So, the magnet is simply, it's got a magnet on it, but it's also got a clip that attaches to the cord. But it doesn't attach to the light fixture. Okay, so that's really what is unique about our product, is that we've got this magnet that is embedded in the base of the light fixture, and you can stick that magnet on a pole or a flashing that's ferrous, and it will hold the light straight out. And that's what the magnetic clip does. It does the exact same thing that our embedded magnet that not made separately, that's all together.
The issue of whether if you have two magnets, you can aggregate their pull strength to meet the limitation of the claim, do you view that as an issue of claim construction, an issue of infringement, an issue of doctrine of equivalence, or something else?
Well, it was an issue of claim construction because it's undisputed that the magnet has more than 5 pounds of pull strength overall. So there's not a question of infringement. It's whether the court interprets that claim to require that each of the magnets has 5 pounds or all of the magnets collectively have 5 pounds. And in order to accomplish the purpose of the invention and avoid, it just doesn't make sense to require two magnets with 5 pounds of pull strength when you only need one magnet with 5 pounds to satisfy the purpose of the invention.
The red brief gives all these examples at pages 24 and 25 of where they say that reasoning would completely sort of eviscerate a whole lot of our doctrine. There's like a chemical patent and all that. You know the examples that I'm referring to?
I think so, but I don't agree with those. First of all, there's not much in the way of context. All of these cases depend on what's in the patent, what's in the claims. In the Biogro case, for example, the context was that the court found that the purpose of it was the concentration, the overall concentration of those acids or salts. And therefore, you should combine them together because that's what the purpose of it is. So it's not going to upend claim construction or infringement contention by interpreting it in a way that's consistent with the purpose behind that magnet.
You're well into your rebuttal time. Do you want to let us hear from the other side?
Yes, sir. I'll reserve my time.
We'll give you 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Greenspoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. With Mr. Allen's consent, and this is completely optional, I do have two of the magnetic clips. They were demonstrative exhibits at the hearing. I know there's a rule-based process for bringing demonstrative, so I can just set these down and forget about them. But if the court is interested, I could hand them to the marshal.
Why don't you just put them aside?
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Stark, in answer to your question about what do we do with a mixed case, what if some of the claims are unreasonable but some are not? Courts have actually tackled that already. So there's a case out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. We did not brief this, I'll alert your honors. We didn't include this case in our papers. Well-Boutrin, 2012 U.S. Dist. Lexis 66312 from 2012. As a matter, and this is a quote from that case, as a matter of policy, that would create poor incentives if tacking one meritorious claim onto any number of baseless ones that delay adjudication or resolution could automatically immunize the whole lawsuit or petition from antitrust liability as a matter of law. Of course, that's talking about North Pennington, which is a cousin to this bad faith issue we're dealing with here.
Mr. Greenspoon, as you know, we're not a policy-making body. Isn't it correct that the injunction is really based on whether the determination that the claims were objectively baseless is correct?
The injunction was based on all four of the main injunction factors, and baked within it was about one-sixth of it are the issues that are briefed by my friend. There is quite a bit more.
But objectively baseless is at the base of this appeal. And as you know, you don't have to be correct with an infringement assertion at the risk of it being objectively baseless. And at times, A means more than one, and the clips were attached, maybe not integrally. So why were the claims correctly found to be objectively baseless or just possibly wrong?
To tackle that, Your Honor, the district court tackled all that and also did that in the context of a fair chance of prevailing.
Was it correct?
Of course, the district court was correct. But the point I'm trying to make is that, and this actually goes to a point from Your Honor, Judge Toronto, the question, the ultimate categorical question of objective baselessness is not before Your Honors. It was not before the district court. This is instead, as Judge Stark indicated, this is that threshold of preliminary injunctive relief of a likelihood of success on the merits, which in the Eighth Circuit means something perhaps less than other circuits. It means a fair chance of prevailing. In this very context of a preliminary injunction and bad faith allegations and so on, we have this court's decision from Mekon Gaming. The outcome actually went against my position, I'll confess, but the analysis is very interesting to me because in Mekon Gaming at the very end, you see that a panel of this court found quote-unquote negligible likelihood of success on the objective unreasonableness prong, but then went on. It still tackled the question of, well, what about, was there a strong irreparable harm showing? Was there a strong balance of the harm showing? What about the public interest? So in other words, we're dealing with this multi-layered beast, which is the preliminary injunction ruling.
Basically, the four elements for a preliminary injunction, although sometimes described as factors, are not on the whole balanced against each other. On the whole, you need each. Now, I think there's some wiggle room about that. But if the district court was wrong, and sort of, clearly wrong, I don't know what the right expression is, to say that the infringement assertions were not just incorrect, but objectively baseless, then it seems to me there's not enough to say, well, nevertheless, we will let him let the district court enjoin speech because there would be irreparable harm and whatnot. The merits piece of the four-part injunction test is something like necessary.
To respond, Your Honor, this goes back to our conversation with Judge Stark, which is in the mixed case scenario, it's not just the district court saying what's nice policy. It's also the Seventh Circuit in MCI Communications v. AT&T 708 F. 2nd 1081 saying that a single baseless claim within a complaint can serve as grounds for a sham litigation claim. So in other words, when we have a mixed scenario, we win if any single of their assertions in their marketplace communications will ultimately be held by the trier of fact to have been objectively baseless.
For an injunction, MCI AT&T was a damages case, right? That was MCI's big damages case against AT&T for trying to keep it out of the long-distance market 1,000 years ago. and if there was one basis that might have been a basis for a wrongful antitrust action, subject to the all-important question of whether that was the but-for cause of the damages cause, then that would surely be right. But your claim is that speech is to be enjoined if any part of the speech is baseless, even if other parts are not? Is that what we're talking about?
That's right, Your Honor. And if we're going to...
And that the entirety of the speech, really, is that really a sound First Amendment principle?
If I
say one thing that's baseless, I can be silenced on the speech for which I do have a basis?
If Nebraska common law calls the whole communication defamatory, then yes, that type of communication can be enjoined. And we do not have any appeal from my friend of the Nebraska common law elements application by the district court. So in Nebraska common law, just like everywhere, there is a substantial truth defense. So if we held up the two pieces of paper from the appendix, and which constitute the offending communication, and if we sort of yellow highlighted the true statements, red highlighted the objectively baseless statements, maybe in the end, a jury will have to deal with the substantial truth defense, maybe because the yellows are more than the reds or vice versa. But here we're dealing with a fair chance of success in the merits. We're trying to balance all these equitable factors and protect the marketplace from unfair competition, untrue statements, and what have you.
Do you agree that in the posture of the case is before us now, we'd have to find that there's at least one objectively baseless statement in the communications that you're unhappy with?
Yes, Your Honor, I accept that. And it's easy for me to accept that because the 264 patent assertion against the magnetic cord was found by the district court.
Where is the 264? Is this the protruding point?
The protruding one, right.
Is that referenced in the communication to your joint customers?
Yes, Your Honor. In two ways. In the very top of the communication, that patent is named.
Right. And, okay, go on.
Right. Appendix 542, Your Honor. Qualified in the one way, it's named there. I was going to point to the next page of the appendix, which has the attachment to that letter that went out to the marketplace, which is the first page of the complaint. In that page, there's no, that patent number is not repeated. But that's the page that says, we explicitly, HPL, copied Lightnetic's patented product. That's the page where Lightnetics is telling the purchasing public that HPL copied their product. Now, that's categorically false. We know that because they're different. There's a patent that's issued by the USPTO on HPL.
What evidence at all do we have in the record of copying and how you devised your product or didn't devise your product?
I missed the first part. I'm sorry.
What evidence do we have in the record? You say it's categorically false.
Right.
They say it's at least objectively reasonable to think that you copied because of how they look like each other, I suppose.
Right.
How do we don't have a record on that, do
well,
we?
Well, Your Honors need not trouble very much on this point because, again, it's another point that my friend did not appeal. There are findings that the copying accusation was objectively baseless, false, defamatory, etc.
Aren't the three statements you're unhappy with, aren't they all intertwined with one another? Don't they all ultimately go back to whether or not they had a reasonable belief that your client infringed one or more of their patent claims?
Well, they're certainly related, but they are different. And the ultimate scope of the injunction is very targeted to these types of statements. They're isolated 1, 2, 3 in terms of type.
I guess I have a high-level question. We go back to the Eighth Circuit standard, because your argument suggests, I think, it should be very easy for an accused infringer to shut down communication about patent rights during the course of a patent case. According to you, I guess the question is, if this looks to us like just a typical patent case at an early stage, there's reasonable arguments for claim construction on both sides, reasonable arguments for whether doctrine of equivalence is available, reasonable disputes over infringement, is it really as easy as if you show a fair chance that maybe they'll lose and lose badly, they now can't talk about their patent for the next 2 to 3 years?
Judge, Your Honor, it's not easy. This is a very special, rare outlier case. And in fact, I would call the claim construction that we've seen in the briefing on the 779 patent, I would call it cringeworthy. And I think Lightnetic's briefing does my work for me. So let me address page 8 of the reply brief, just a heading there, and I'll quote their heading. The 779 patent covers one or more magnets having an aggregated pull strength of at least 5 pounds. Compare that with what the claim actually says, which is a neodymium magnet embedded in the base, wherein said magnet has a pull strength of at least 5 pounds.
If I think at this early stage that's a reasonable claim construction position, you lose this appeal. Is that right? At least my vote, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because we have an opportunity eventually at the end of the case to convince a trier of fact that it's objectively baseless. But again, let's feed forward to where we are today. We're at the point of interim equitable relief. We have this relatively light likelihood of success burden in the Eighth Circuit. So we've done all the work necessary to show that we have a fair chance of prevailing, proving that this is rank blue lining of a patent claim, which courts don't do. That's not claim construction. That's editing. So we're back to, in this appeal, has Lightnetics established that there was any abuse of discretion by the district court? And, Your Honors, I would submit that there has not been.
Can you explain a little bit more on the clips? What does the record say about, and I don't know what this is a highly non-technical term, how snugly the clip fits to the base of the bulb carrying unit?
You could go to the record of Mr. Gennenbacher's declaration for that answer. I don't have the page number handy, but it should be very easy to find. He says correctly, I'm not going to pick them up, I'm going to use my hand. He says correctly that the end of the pre-existing socket presses against the bottom of the clip. And if you look on the bottom of the clip, there's no attachment mechanism whatsoever. It's like a flat piece of plastic.
But it presses against it.
Presses against.
And the raised lip of the clip, if that's what one wants to call it, presses against the cylindrical surface of the base?
The district court originally thought that in the TRO order, but having reviewed the demonstrative exhibits, he corrected himself and he realized the sides don't do any kind of hugging.
Okay.
Instead, the sides have these
arms
that go this way.
Asked him to make that correction, or they did? Is that?
No one asked for that correction. Okay. It's just when he got to the preliminary injunction opinion, he corrected himself. He said, I might have said something incorrectly, but here's the way it is. If you look at the arms, they sort of
hug
the light cord. And installation on the light cord is exactly the disclaimed material. Installation of a clip on the light cord, full stop.
Right, so the arms that come up, but as I understand it, the arms come up out of a little disc, and the disc has a little lip around it.
That's right.
Right, and I was, I guess, curious whether both the disc part of the clip and the little lip part, not the arms, whether both of those, you said that the disc part does actually touch the bottom of the base. Does the rim part also touch the bottom? Not the bottom, but just above the bottom of the base?
I don't quote me because I just don't know the answer. I think the circumference might be a little bigger than a typical light socket. So there would be some outer edge of the lip that doesn't touch even any part of the circumference of the base. I believe that's how it works.
Okay. Also, doesn't an abuse of discretion include an error of law?
It can include an error of law, but again,
isn't claim construction a question of law?
If my friend had demonstrated just a categorical error of law in all parts of the claim construction, this would be a different case. Then I would concede we have to go back and revisit the preliminary injunction.
Anything further?
If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I would just ask on behalf of HBL that this court protect fair competition, honesty, fair play in the marketplace. Remember, these are assistant managers of hardware stores who are getting these notices. This was way over the top, and affirm the preliminary injunction.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, we'll give you your full rebuttal time back. 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I wanted to address the allegation that if any of our claim construction arguments are wrong, we lose. Well, how could that be true? The communication was not about claim construction. It was about we sued the appellee on these two patents. We don't even identify the two products that we sued them on in either this communication or the letter. So how can you say that this letter is false if any claim is successful? So if we win on the magnetic cord, we win on the claims regarding this letter. If we win on the clip, we win on this letter because, again, neither one of them are identified here in the letter. And furthermore, contrary to the appellee's counsel's argument, the court did, in fact, rely heavily on all of those Nebraska common law claims in finding that this case was objectively baseless. And that's, you can find that in the court's memo starting at page 49 of the appendix to page 54. Again, the court acknowledges that federal patent law provides a privilege, but he points out the exception. We kept arguing, look, if it's objectively, it has to be objectively baseless, and if it doesn't meet that standard, these claims should not stand. We shouldn't get the injunction.
Can we talk a little bit more about the clips? Would you agree that you disclaimed some use of some type of clips, or are you denying all disclaimer?
So the clip is a broad term. It's a term that's actually used in our dependent claims to show how the base can clip to the second end of the light socket. So to just say that all clips whatsoever are disclaimed would be contrary to the law.
I figured you would say that, but yeah. Would you agree that you disclaimed some narrower use of clips in the context of magnetic lights?
Well, with respect to Dugan and Clement, if you look at those prior art references, I think, yes, we couldn't claim that one of those clips infringed our patent because it's not even attached to the...
So how, for example, is Clement's use of clips different than HBL's use of clips?
It's different because they attach it to the light cord only. The use of the clips in the case of the appellee is that they're clipping it to the cord adjacent to light fixture. It actually clamps snugly against that light fixture, and it holds, with the wire itself is part of the light fixture too because it gets clamped down. So the wire is part of the light fixture. The clip clips onto the wires.
So Clement could clip anywhere along the cord, but HBL's product has to clip near the light?
The difference between HBL's product and these other products is that it attaches to the base. Our argument is it attaches to the base. There doesn't have to be a mechanical connection directly to the base. The mechanical connection here is indirect as far as what holds it on. The clips hold a clip to the wires, and that's what holds the magnetic clip snug with the base. But by doing that, you're attaching that clip to the base of this light fixture. None of the other prior art references are doing that.
Thank you, both counsel. Case is submitted.